So last night we celebrated here a refuge ritual for about 30 people, and it's the first time we've done it here in our center. And then next week, in doing the Buddhist birthday celebration, we'll do a teeny bit of chanting as part of that, and the chanting would be taking the refuges in Pali. And since it was on my mind last night so much, it's still with me, that ceremony, and since it's going to be next week, I thought I'd talk a little bit about this notion of going for refuge. It's a very central Buddhist idea. And it's conventionally also sometimes taken to be a definition of when you become a Buddhist, is when you've kind of taken refuge. Though I think there are plenty of people who take refuge who don't necessarily consider themselves Buddhist as a result of that. And it could be seen as kind of a religious act. And I'm very aware that in the modern America, there's a lot of people who are allergic to the word religion. I have friends of mine, colleagues of mine, who are Vipassana teachers, who are allergic to using the word religion in connection to their teaching and their activities. It's spiritual, what they do. It's not religious. And perhaps in that kind of separation, spirituality tends to be focusing on internal states, internal movements of your heart, feelings, your own experience, your own kind of... Whereas religion has to do more with, in this kind of view, is that perhaps more with externals, rituals. It has more to do with creeds and beliefs. And an institution, a church, a religious institution... And in that kind of external focus, the internal transformation, internal development of these spiritual qualities sometimes overlooked or eclipsed or squashed. And many commentators have pointed out this is a very strong trend in American religions in general, not just in Buddhism, in the last 20, 30 years, for people to focus on spirituality instead of religiosity. But maybe going for refuge is a little bit more religious in that it's an expression or affirmation or confirmation or of what's already inside of oneself in an external way. It's taking an external form. And so the line between internal and external is a little bit blurry with going for refuge. So it's maybe a deeply spiritual movement for someone, or it's a religious movement. And it can be quite powerful for some people. The Pali word for refuge is saranam. And it's sometimes likened to the word for cave. A kind of synonym is a cave or a shelter. It's a place you go for shelter, for support, for refuge. Sometimes jokingly, some people will say those people who go for refuge have become refugees. And it's kind of nice. I like kind of a little bit because... there's a notion in Buddhism of becoming homeless, and homeless can mean literally being homeless. If you become a Buddhist monastic, you don't have a home. But also the spirit of homeless is that you're not going to let your mind get attached to any place or anything. So home is a place with tremendous attachment for people. And so even though you might have a home, the homeless movement in Buddhism is you're not going to be attached to that. At the time of the Buddha, if you read the discourses of the Buddha, it seems that the Buddha the only way that the Buddha encouraged people to take refuge is to take refuge in oneself. And there's a beautiful passage in the last days of the Buddha where he talks about himself being old. He's 80 years old, he's old, he's worn out, he's in constant pain, constant discomfort, except when he uses his meditative abilities to somehow withdraw his attention from his coarse kind of physical sensations of his body so he doesn't feel his pain anymore. So you can imagine this old man, who's in discomfort and probably knows he's going to die soon. And so in this context, he says, be a refuge unto yourself. So the only kind of admonition or encouragement, teaching the Buddha had for how you should take refuge is take refuge in yourself. And then he explained then what they meant by that. You take refuge in yourself by taking refuge in, by being mindful. And he went through the four foundations of mindfulness, being mindful of your experiences of your body, being mindful of your feelings, being mindful of your mental states, and being mindful of your inner processes of freedom and that which moves you to freedom, that which moves you to greater suffering or greater enslavement. And so in the Buddha's encouragement for taking refuge is kind of what would be categorized perhaps as more spiritual, this internal focus in the sense of take responsibility, look within, notice what goes on with you, notice where you're attached, notice where the movements of freedom is within yourself. And the Buddha put tremendous emphasis on our personal responsibility. He didn't use those words, but personal responsibility to really track what we are doing with our own minds and our own hearts. And the reason for that is by tracking what goes on with our own minds and our hearts, we can make choices about how we relate to the world, how we speak, how we act, and how we are internally with the world around us. If you're some people, you know, recently I was talking to someone who had went into a difficult family situation. And the person said, I had to really track carefully. I had to watch myself really carefully. I had to track, my reactions and responses. Otherwise, it would have been a disaster in my family. I think it was a mother who was dying in the hospital. So it was going on for a very long time. So the family members were starting to get, there's a lot of stress around that because people dropped their lives and what to do and what to do about support and not support. And so the person said, the person had no Buddhist background, but said, it was really important that I watched myself really carefully. So as not to create greater suffering and problems in everyone, including oneself. So the Buddha said, be a refuge unto yourself. And the way you be a refuge unto yourself is by having this strong sense of presence, strong sense of awareness here. Not just focused internally as a way of losing yourself in the inner life, but as a way of being focused internally so that the boundaries and barriers to the world around us don't have to be so hard and fast, but we can take responsibility of how we enter into the world. It's sometimes said in our circles that, a little cliche, that suffering is optional. And of course, that's it's a very profound statement, but it also can be heard the wrong way because there is a tremendous amount of suffering that the world puts on us. People treat each other terribly, and to hear that suffering is optional, you're responsible for your suffering when someone is oppressing you, is not, sometimes it's the message of the oppressor. It's your problem, not mine. But the Buddhist idea of that is that it has to do with this taking responsibility, tracking how we react and how we respond in relationship to circumstances. And the refuge and the protection of the Dharma, ultimately, at its essence, is a protection from ourselves adding unnecessary suffering in a situation that might already be bad. The Buddha, being old and being in pain, he was in a difficult situation we could think of, but he wasn't going to suffer because of it. He wasn't going to feel regret or fear or hate around his state. And so he was able to stay somewhat at peace in his old age. So to take refuge in oneself is to be able to turn in and know where to find the resources so that we can find ourselves in any situation in life and find some way to be at peace, or the kind of peace that comes from when we know how not to get agitated because of those circumstances. The circumstances might be bad, but we don't get agitated. We don't add problems on top of it. It's said in the ancient commentaries that when a person goes for refuge, they no longer have any reason to complain about the world. Is it the word rail against the world? To rail against the world or be upset because there's no meaning or no order in the world. Things are not as they should be in the world. Of course, things aren't as they should be in the world. But I think the meaning of this, not complaining anymore, is that going for refuge gives a person an orientation in life where they always have a sense of meaning or purpose for how to relate to what's happening in the world. It gives them an orientation. So they, no matter how dire it becomes, they have some idea. Oh, I can do this. I know there's meaning. The order, the world has been somehow given a sense of purpose or a sense of definition. That no matter what's going on, I have my practice. And what goes on, I can look for where is it I can find freedom? Where can I find compassion and love, peace in the midst of what's going on? I might not understand what's going on. What's going on in the world might be unjust, might be problematic. But within that, you know, if I can't deal with the injustice of the world, if I can't change what's happening in the world, then I always know where the path of freedom is. And that is to go in and be with my own heart, find the freedom of my own heart. I don't know if this is an appropriate example, but some of us were here last Wednesday when this fellow talked about his experience teaching drumming at St. Quentin. And he talked about one fellow who was in jail, was 57 years old, and was in St. Quentin for manslaughter. Apparently, he had five brothers who were also in prison in various places for having committed murder. And he had turned his life around in prison and was kind of a radiant being, you know, very, very present. And, I lost my train of thought. Kind of in the middle of that interesting story about St. Quentin. Oh, yeah, now I remember. So there's an example, you know, of someone who goes in, someone and takes a very difficult situation like being in prison and turns it around and is able to find where the peace and the freedom within, inside the bars of freedom. And I taught once at the federal women's prison nearby, and I had the same impression. I met a woman there who had been there for 7 years and had devoted those 7 years to yoga and meditation. And she was more alive and present and radiant and free than most of the people that I meet in the context of going on retreats and everything. And then there were other women who were there at the little one-day retreat that I was sitting, who there was no effort at all. They were kind of leaning against the wall and kind of napping. I don't know, they came there because, you know, it was a chance to hang out with a guy, I guess, or something, you know, and not do other things you do. I don't know why they were there. I certainly weren't interested in what I was saying. And other women who were there who were complaining, kind of complaining mode about the prison and how they're treated and all that. And there was one person, she sat right in front of me, like that far away, stood, you know, you know, it was like, I was ready to bow to her. So, you know, what is it that creates freedom and what is it that creates enslavement or imprisonment for us? And, how, you know, and some people learn how to be free in any circumstance at all. And what does that take? So to be take refuge in oneself, I think, points to finding that. And to have a path, to know a path of how to look for that and how to practice for that. So no matter what the situation is, we don't complain about the world. We might try to change it for the better, but, you know, we're not going to feel oppressed by it because we know, at least know the path of how to find our own freedom in the midst of that. So that was kind of what all the Buddha said, as far as I can know from the suttas, is be a refuge unto yourself. However, there's a lot of examples in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, of the Buddha giving a discourse to some people or talking to someone. And he talked to all kinds of people. He talked to, the whole range of society, all the different classes and groups in society. And he seemed to wander around and treat everyone equally and enter into conversations with people. And then sometimes after those conversations and the giving a talk, the Buddha would say, the people listening would say, I now go for refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. So in the discourses, there are records of people then being moved to do something in relationship to what they learned from the Buddha, how they are moved by the Buddha. And what they did was they took refuge. And there was no indication the Buddha stopped them from doing that. Though he never told them to do that. So I like to think of that as people were so moved by what they learned, so moved by the presence of the Buddha perhaps, by the teachings, so moved by the message they got, that they wanted to reorient their lives in a new perspective. Turn their lives around, reorganize their life around the perspective of these teachings that the Buddha gave. So they ask, you know, or they said, I'll now go for refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Like, so the first people who did it only took refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma because there was no Sangha yet. And then later on there became a Sangha, and then they took refuge in the triple refuge. And so how is it that a person gets changed, turned, converted is the kind of a Western word, which can be understood. We know in the Western context can be a very powerful movement when a person has a conversion experience. But I think that religious or spirituality does involve a kind of turning. And the question is, what kind of turning is it for you? Some kind of turning where a person is seeing there's another way of living my life. I can live differently now. I don't have to live by the old way. And the old way being one perhaps that creates a lot of suffering and difficulties. I don't have to live always worrying. One of the functions of refuge is to destroy fear in a person. So something about the refuge destroys fear. I don't have to live anymore based on greed or attachments. I don't have to live on values which don't ultimately support the movement towards freedom or the movement of compassion. And I meet lots of people who make these kinds of changes or these turns in their lives in small ways. They decide, this way of talking to other people is not really healthy. I don't want to talk this way anymore. I don't want to always be gossiping or bitching or whatever, complaining or whatever way it might be. And so they kind of, I'll try to change how I talk. Certain people, about how they work, the kind of careers they have, they realize, that career doesn't really conducive. And I've known people who've changed careers, gone back to school or done something. Or I don't want to be relate in my work environment in that kind of way anymore. The work environment is very competitive. People are, you know, and I don't want to be in competition to other people at work anymore. I don't want to be undercutting other people. And I want to treat people with dignity and honesty and be that way myself. So some kind of turning that people make. Part of the turning is a turning of trust. To trust that there's another way of living life, where they take refuge in something which is reliable, as opposed to the movement of refuge in things which are unreliable. And it's quite common for Dharma teachers to point out all the unreliable things that people take refuge in. And you know, all the examples I've often talked about, but things like, you know, if you take refuge in your home, and then you come home and your home is burnt down, which happened to one Dharma student of mine. That she came home and she had nothing. She went to the beach, so you don't take much with you to the beach. Keys and your driver's license. And her home was also her office. And it was the Oakland fire back in the early 90s. And we all know how quickly so many things that we depend on can turn around and they're no longer there. A relationship. Suddenly, that for some reason, the relationship is not there anymore. The person dies, or the person wants a divorce, or the person whatever. And we depended on that in some way. I know a lot of people around here, probably some of you in this room even, who had started to build a future for yourselves on your stock investments. And at least people have talked to me about how they were building a future. And just, you know, I'm just waiting for that stock option to play itself out. And I really want to quit, but I'm going to hold out. And they come back to me a year later and say, well, I held out. But by the time I held out, when I finally could exercise a stock option, the stock was worthless. And one person came and said, you know, toilet paper was worth more than my stock option. And so building a future, relying on certain things. Some people rely on their health. The Buddha, you know, couldn't rely on his health. It became an old, painful body. It's one example, one little story where he talks about himself. He talks about his being in his old age, being bent over, stooped over. Man, this old man kind of bent over. You think of the Buddha as being kind of, you know, look at that, you know. And usually he's depicted in statues and stuff as being relatively young. And you don't get many statues of him. I don't know of any statues of him being 80 years old. And another description, he describes his face being all wrinkled. You know, he's supposed to be, you know, wrinkle-free when you're a Buddha, right? Always young, right? meditate's the elixir of youth. And even your health is not something you can ultimately depend on. My teacher in Burma, Upandita, he sometimes would love to, I think he loved saying this. It could be this gleam in his eye, he would say, as you get older, your body just gets more and more worn down. But if you practice, your mind just gets more and more luminous. But sometimes we can't even rely on our mind. And then we have, you know, our dollar bills that say, you know, in God we trust, as if that's supposed to make our money more secure. And I'm waiting for that to happen to America, what happened when I was in Burma, where overnight they canceled the value of most of the currency. And, you know, people woke up in the morning and the money they had just was worthless. And it was a way of kind of catching the black marketeers who didn't keep their money in the bank. And but a lot of people didn't keep the money in the bank in Burma because they didn't trust the Burmese banks. So what do we rely on? And so the idea being that there's kind of, then at some point people turn from one thing they rely on to something else. And, you know, I think most people have done that as they grow up. I think it's inevitable. When I was a teenager, I relied on girls. And, you know, and as I got older, my orientation changed about, you know, where my happiness was going to come from. And so we change, you know, what we depend on our happiness for. We think happiness is what's going to create happiness. And ultimately, what the Buddha was teaching is that what's the reliable refuge, reliable source of security, is not in the external world, depending on the external world to make you happy, but is some movement of freedom in your own hearts. And a path that moves you in that direction, a process of moving you in that direction. So taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha was never something the Buddha told people to do, but it's something that people voluntarily did on their own. That somehow it spoke or expressed something powerful movement within themselves. And the way that I offered the refuge ceremony last night was in that spirit. Was that I didn't want to impose any idea of what refuge meant on the people doing it. As if there was a Buddhist way or proper way, or there's like, now you're making a commitment to me or a commitment to something external. But rather how I understood it is that the people who wanted to do it, something had been awakened in themselves, in their own hearts. So, and so some people it was, you know, varying degrees or in various understandings or whatever. It didn't really matter to me. The fact that something was awakened, some turning, some new understanding of a new orientation that they wanted to live their life by. And I felt it was very, very powerful, very important to give voice to that, to express, give expression to that, to have in a ritual way, to offer it as a kind of commitment. Yes, I'm going to take this commitment. This is important for me. But something each individual person was doing for themselves, because in a voluntary way, because it was important for them. And I also suggested last night that in offering the refuge in that spirit, it was actually a much more difficult way to live by it. Because sometimes if you make a commitment to an external person or an institution or something and are accountable that in an external way, it's actually easier because it's kind of easier to see, you know, perhaps. But if you really are only accountable to yourself, it's actually, it can be much more difficult to do. Because you don't have that kind of support or the peer pressure or all the other things that come when you do it in other ways. So I was quite moved yesterday by the spirit of the people who were there and what I felt, dedication and a sense of purpose and meaning in which they infused a ceremony with. To take refuge in the Buddha, it said... to take refuge in the Buddha as the exemplar, as the discoverer, as the person who found this possibility of freedom and compassion and peace, the path towards it. I like to point out that this particular gathering of people here today, this Sunday morning, we wouldn't all be here together at this particular juncture in our lives if it hadn't been for the Buddha. The Buddha set in motion the teachings and the path of Buddhism, And somehow, after 2,500 years, it has manifested in the form of this gathering of people being in this room at this particular time in Redwood City. I mean, if the Buddha had never lived, we would probably be doing other things. You know, we probably maybe found things that are as profound and significant for us, but chances are we wouldn't be together. You know, some of us would be, you know, indifferent, doing different things. So the Buddha, you know, set it all in motion. The Buddha was the example of how it was. For me, the Buddha is not just a person, but is also a kind of, I don't know if archetype is the right word, but kind of a representative of a possibility. To the degree to which I have tasted peace and freedom and compassion in my own heart, I get a sense, a vision, of what it would be like to take that peace and freedom and compassion and have it thoroughly integrated throughout my being. And so the Buddha represents to me that possibility of that full integration of those states in my life completely. And I'm inspired by that. And to move my life in that direction, and to have someone, you know, kind of as a representative of that possibility, it's very helpful, kind of encouraging for me. The Buddha is also said to be the example of, not to represent the possibility of awakening within each of us. So it's not the person we take refuge in, but rather the awakening the Buddha experienced. And that awakening, we take refuge in that possibility for ourselves. We take refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma is, the word Dharma in its etymology, in its root meaning, means a support, that which holds a person up. So that which offers support keeps us from falling into states of suffering, falling into states of despair, into complaining, to say it, you know, mildly. But that which supports our life. So the Dharma is not just simply a teaching the Buddha offered, but more profoundly, more importantly, the Dharma is the process of liberation. The truths that are liberating. And the truth not just being kind of a creed, but the truth involves a process of practice, a process of turning the mind, turning the heart away from what it clings to and what it holds on to towards freedom and peace. And the Sangha, as a refuge, is a community of people. Is primarily, essentially, the Sangha is those people who've witnessed or tasted the experience of awakening, this truth or this peace that the Buddha pointed to. And the reason why that's the essential Sangha is that they can be relied on as a refuge and support, as someone who's done it. Other people who are Sangha, we say here people here are Sangha, can't be relied on in the same complete way because we all might make mistakes. There's lots of examples in the Buddhist world of Buddhist teachers who have made mistakes. And people have, you know, depended on the Buddhist teachers, taken refuge in the Buddhist teacher, and then the Buddhist teacher has done some horrible ethical transgression. And then people say, oh, you know, how could, you know, but not all Buddhist teachers are fully awakened. So to take refuge, essentially, is to take refuge in those people who have tasted awakening. It's also said to take refuge in Sangha, in those people who have attained awakening. But there is a kind of refuge we take in the wider community of people who are not awakened or fully awakened. I find it very, very powerful for me, and very supportive and very encouraging to be together with other people who are practicing, whose intention are to be present, intention is to be honest, to live in truth, the intention is to live a life of compassion. And I meet people a lot and talk to them about their lives, and it moves me so much to see how people are trying their best to live from a deeper intention, trying to find what that's like, and to sometimes struggle to find what that's like. And apply themselves, often in difficult circumstances, to really make their best efforts. It's really inspiring, our people who make that effort. There's a teaching in Zen that teachers of old, the great enlightened teachers of old, were just like us. That they're no different than us when they were engaging in their process of practice. then they hung in there long enough to see the transformative effects of the practice. But they were just like us, each of us. Each of us has that capacity if we hang in there. And one of the things that moves me the most around Dharma practice is those people who have tremendous difficulty in their practice, but who hang in there for years and are changed because of it. That moves me to no end. As there are people whom Dharma practice is relatively easy, and that's really wonderful. I'm very happy for them. But there's something about that people hanging in there and, you know, kind of knocking their head against the wall sometimes for years. It's seemingly making no progress, but being changed and slowly, slowly, slowly. One of my favorite expressions of the Buddha is, with dripping drops of water, the water jug is filled. You know, we'd like to just turn on the faucet and have them filled quickly. Dripping drops of water, the pool is filled. You know, just little movements, little steps, little intentions we follow through on. So to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is a way of destroying fear, uncertainty. It offers certainty. It gives us a path. It gives us always something to do in any circumstance that we find ourselves in. A place where we can find our dignity, our freedom, regardless if other people treat us without it, as people find in prison, some people. Nelson Mandela was a great example of, if you read his autobiography. The last thing I'll say about refuge. The triple refuge, sometimes called the three refuges or the triple refuge, the refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It's sometimes also called the triple jewels, the triple treasure. And the Pali word for that is ratana. Now, the ancient commentators, they love etymology. And it's not ancient, they still do it. When I was with Upandita, he took one word called puttajana, which usually translated as an tanjef, Tanisra Bhikkhu translates it as a run-of-the-mill person. But an ordinary, unenlightened person is a puttajana. And I went to Dharma talks with him every day when I was in Burma with Upandita. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, he divided up that word, puttajana, in probably 14 or 21 different ways of looking at etymology, making up. They're all fanciful, I think, you know. It was a way of offering teachings through kind of looking at the roots of the meaning of the word. So one of the ways in which these ancient commentators talk about the ratana, in terms of the three treasures, the three jewels, is that it comes from the word rati. And rati means delight. And so the three treasures, three jewels, are that which delights the heart. So that's the spirit of taking refuge, of the refuge, is that which delights the heart. And I hope that all of you can find that delight. It doesn't have to be in Buddhist terms, but I hope that you find in your life that which brings delight to your heart and freedom to it. So those are my thoughts for today. And we have about 5 minutes if anyone wants to say something or ask questions.
In the more traditional look at Sangha, isn't it true that it's like the monks, like you were kind of alluding to that, that it's those who are really tasted enlightenment?
Well, the technical definition of Sangha, the old way, was it's those who have tasted awakening. And it could be monks or lay people. Monks, nuns, or lay people. Monastics or lay people. That's the most essential meaning. Then a wider circle, and it's, wider circle is the right word, but another meaning is the monastic community, mm-hmm. is a Sangha. And what's happened for various historical reasons, partly because of what was happening in East Asia, partly what happens in non-Buddhist Indian traditions, And the word sangha has wider meanings. It's taken to be have wider meanings. So that it basically means community, or a spiritual community, a practice community. So in the modern West, in America, sangha has come to mean our practice community. And it's not limited just to the monastic community or those who have awakened. But we should always know that even though we can be greatly inspired by our practice community, that a practice community also is made up of people who are imperfect. So one of the things, one of the ways I think of a practice community is a community where no one ever turns their back towards anybody. And so there, we expect to have difficulties. We expect, you know, no one's expected to be perfect here. But that that when there's conflict and tension in the community, that this practice community is a community that is committed to stopping and looking at that and being with it, at least individuals of this conflict between people. And that, you know, so that the community becomes a place where everybody feels safe to come, because even if there might be tensions and difficulties, there's a commitment to hang in there, work it out, clarify it, and resolve it, to find reconciliation. And so that commitment is one of the things that makes a practice community a refuge and a safe place, because that commitment to hang in there and work out the difficulties. Yes?
I read something recently about the ceremony of taking the refuges and precepts, and I guess I'd like your commentary on it. This teacher said that when a student does that, that what part of what he or she is doing is simply saying, I'm done shopping at the spiritual supermarket. This is my path.
I think it is meaningful. I think there's lots of people who feel like, you know, when they found their path for their life, their central organizing principle or orientation for their life, this is how they're going to orient their lives primarily. So it makes a lot of sense that some people would say that. Myself, I'm reluctant to make a kind of categorical statement like that, because there's all kinds of ways people are. There's such a wide range of ways people find their commitment, find their dedication, and some people, it's an inkling they have first, and so they want to support that inkling, and that inkling will grow. And while that inkling is growing, they might be involved in other traditions. It harkens, in my mind at least, maybe not the teacher's point of view, but harkens in my mind a little bit to the danger of an old-fashioned idea that religions are exclusive of each other. And, you know, it's the one and true way I found it. And I think that idea is kind of absent in Buddhism in general, that there's, you know, that that Buddhism is the one and true religion, and this is the one way. There might be other, you know, things we can borrow and learn and from other traditions. And the person might be firmly rooted in the Buddha Dharma, but there might be other things to find in other places. Sometimes I encourage people to do, you know, all kinds of things. I don't know. It's pretty common in the American Buddhist circles. It's kind of a eclectic scene. People are constantly learning from other places, other Buddhist groups, and from other places. So spiritual shopping is being a spiritual consumer is kind of dangerous. I don't think that's the spirit of what real spirituality is about. The expression spiritual shopping has the in my mind, it might not be in your minds, but in my mind, has the idea of going out and getting something, buying something as a commodity, and the only criteria is what's in it for me, in the narrowest sense, most selfish sense of what's in it for me. Even though the Buddha said take refuge in oneself, that wasn't meant to be selfish, self-absorbed, and. And spiritual shopping has a sense, you know, there's no commitment, there's no offering anything back. It's just, you know, what's in it for me? I'll take what I can get, and then off we go, you know. So is that respond? Am I kind of?
I just wanted your take on it.
There was a take. Yes.
One of the things that I've struggled with, I think, is this notion of essential sangha. Because actually, as a lay person, it's hard to know who these enlightened beings are. And I think there's something about the way the tradition works where people don't stand up and say, you know, I'm at level one or I'm at level two, that you can tell, okay, this is a person. So it really depends on me having some sense of each teacher or each person that I see that seems to have some degree of realization to kind of judge for myself as to what, kind of how reliable that person is.
Yeah.
You know, that there doesn't, but that, kind of looking for the essential Sangha in itself seems like changes as my own practice deepens.
I think as a person's practice deepens, they get different eyes. They can see differently, different things in other people. So that it's more easy to recognize the freedom that someone expresses, the freedom someone has realized. Because as you get a sense of that through your own practice. I think that's part of the art of being a Dharma student is the degree to which you want to receive teachings from other people and guidance from others, just to get a sense of, you know, what that person can offer you and maybe what the limitations of that person are. It's really quite helpful to have some contact, to have met some people who are deeply realized. You don't necessarily have to study with them, but just to have met such a person and realized what's possible with the human heart. When I was in Calcutta, I went and visited Deepama. And I had no plans to go study with her. But Deepama is considered to be she was a laywoman, Indian laywoman, who was considered one of the most highly attained people in coming out of the particular tradition I studied with in Burma. And it was lovely to go spend time with her, and just I'm very glad to have met her and met someone like her. For me, the idea of the people I've met who have been very inspired by what I sensed was their degree of realization was mostly inspired me for the possibility. It gave me an example, gave me a sense of what that was like. Other people have been more important teachers for me. Skills of being teacher and skills so sometimes a little bit different than not all realized people have skills in teaching and things like that. For me, the refuge in the Sangha, if you keep it limited to this idea of the essential Sangha, then to me it's not so much the people I know or need to know them, but it's more, again, they represent that possibility. To know that there have been people down through the centuries who have tasted the same thing as the Buddha tasted, to me is really inspiring because it tells me it's possible. If it was just, you know, a one-time thing that the Buddha attained, you know, then it wouldn't have much meaning. So I'm just trying to respond in some way.
Reconciliation as part of the mechanisms that might needs to happen when ordinary people are in conflict. I wonder if the Sangha or if this Sangha or if Spirit Rock has sort of a mechanism or some precedent for resolving conflict among people, because I don't know it.
We don't, at our center here, we don't have any formal process. We don't have an ethics committee. We don't have a ethics committee. We don't have a process of, you know, grievance process or reconciliation process. I've talked a little bit of it. Maybe at some point we should probably get something like that into place to be helpful. I've kind of relied on the fact that we're kind of small and at this point. And then we'll figure out how to do it when we need to. And we have. There's been conflict in our community. And sometimes we've put together processes to take care of that when needed. But I'm very aware of this idea because and the usefulness of it because I was involved both at the San Francisco Zen Center and at Spirit Rock, putting together their processes and committees for ethics. And one of the things that I did kind of was that I named the ethics committee in both organizations the same name. Ethics and Reconciliation Council or Committee or Council. And because the acronym for Ethics and Reconciliation is EAR. EAR Council. And one of the primary functions of the EAR Council is to listen to people. Be a confidential body that people can listen to. So Spirit Rock has that in place, the EAR Council. And so does Zen Center. And there's a document that talks about both. You know, both groups have documents that talk about the nature of the EAR Council. And it's a little bit different, the two organizations, how they work. And my hope is that the different Buddhist groups around the country would all adopt this notion of the EAR Council. And so, partly so we have some sense of a shared understanding of the importance of listening and reconciliation. And okay. Thank you all very much.